little bit that I'm going to use two examples for organ formation. One of them will be the neural tube, right? The spinal cord, right? There's a spinal cord here at the base of the brain. They're all formed together from the neural tube. And the other example that I'll use is the lens of the eye, okay? And both of these form in the same kind of way, mechanistically, right? They both start off as an epithelial sheet, which I know you've spoken about that with Dr. Moshowitz. They start off as an epithelial sheet, and they form a tube, okay, in the case of the neural tube, or they form a sphere, as in the case of the lens. And really, you'll see as we go along, that they're doing this in the same way, but they're actually ending up with a different shape. And so we see that a lot of the organs actually use this mechanism where they start off as a sheet, okay, and form a tube or a sphere or some variation of that, and then you end up getting an organ. And I'd like to talk to you about how we make that organ. And to do that, I'm going to first talk about how we do that mechanistically. So what does the cytoskeleton do? You know, what components do we need to make that happen? And then I'm going to talk about how those cells are induced to make that tube or sphere. Okay. So to start off, I'd like to describe to you an experiment that was done. And this experiment, what they did was, is they took an embryo, as you can see over here, this green embryo, that has progressed far enough that the neural tissue has differentiated into neural tissue. So this, what you see here at the top, is the beginning of the formation of neural tissue, okay? And then the outer layer down here, okay, is the future outer layer of the skin or the epidermis, okay? And so what they've done is they've taken cells from this region that would normally become epidermis, okay? And now they've already been differentiated, so they've already, that would mean they've been determined, so they're not going to change their fate unless they're really manipulated very strongly, okay? So they've pretty much decided. And then we take a second embryo, and we take cells from that region of where these cells are going to become neural tubes. We take those cells, we dissociate them, we mix them together, okay? And we look to see what happens. And what we see is that like cells become associate with each other. So those cells that were going to become, or the green cells that were going to become the outer layer of the skin, now are all next to each other. And if we cut this open and we look inside, this is a cross section, we can see that they are all touching each other. And all of those cells that were going to become neural tube are all touching each other. Okay, so they have sorted according to type. So like types sort. Okay, but what does this mean? What's actually going on inside? And this is kind of the mystery that when they did this experiment, they had to try to figure out. And what they saw is that because these cells had gone down this lineage pathway and had been determined to become the outer layer of the skin, there was something different, or different proteins were expressed in these cells than were expressed in these cells. And one of those proteins that's expressed that's different is actually a cell surface molecule called cadherin. And we see that, here it's shown as a dimer, it doesn't have to be as a dimer. We see here that we have a cadherin that is bound through linker proteins that you see here to actin filaments or microfilaments, okay? Part of the cytoskeleton. So, we see that there are, in this case you're seeing a dimer, it doesn't have to be a dimer, but it likes to link up with other cadherins of the same type. So, what does that mean? When the embryo starts off and you start dividing into a multicellular organism, all of the cells express E cadherin. Okay, E, at one time when they first found E cadherin, it was actually because it was found on the epidermis, what we just talked about, the outer layer of the skin, so they called it E cadherin. As things progress, that can change. But all the cells start off expressing E cadherin. The cells of the neural tube, which we just looked at a moment ago, right, here, once they have been induced to become neural tube, they all express N cadherin, or neural coherent. So they're actually expressing different proteins that are bound in their plasma membranes. Just to orient you, please realize that this is the plasma membrane, this is the cytosol of the cell, and this would be then the portion that protrudes into the extracellular space. Okay, so now that we know that these proteins prefer to bind with another protein of the same type, now let's look at this experiment again. What we see is that these cells will sort. So if we have those that were from the epidermis, they will be expressing the E-coherens. And now the red cells have been induced to express now a different coherin called N-coherin. And these cells sort so that all of those that express E-coherin are in one spot, and all of those that express N-coherin are next to each other, so they can bind. So they try to have as little space as possible binding cells that are different or express different proteins on their cell surface. But this is not only a matter of is it a different coherin, but it is also true as to the amount or the number of coherins that are expressed. Okay? And so if you're expressing a high level of E-coherin, you want to be in contact with other cells or bind E-coherins from cells that are expressing that same approximate number. Okay? And so it sorts not only by types of coherins, but also quantities, so that all of those that are expressing high levels will be near each other, and all of those that are expressing low levels will be near each other. And so what we'll see if we have two cells, and they're both expressing coherins that are binding. Let's say they're both expressing E coherin in this example. And then those E coherins are linked up to microfilaments through these adaptive proteins. These are the microfilaments, and this would be the cytosol of one cell and the other. So we see that we have these linkers that are linking between the cells, and then they're linking to the cytoskeleton. And so this also gives these cells rigidity and strength. And so if you remember, I know that Dr. Moshowitz spoke about epithelial sheets. Because I have a lot to draw, I'm going to start on the top board and then move down, so it'll be progressive. If you think about the epithelial sheet, basolateral domain. If you remember, there are adherin junctions in between these cells close to the apical domain. Those adherin junctions are actually bound to each other. What is linking between those two cells is actually also coherin. Okay? So you have coherins here, each of these coherin junctions that are connecting these two cells to each other. But they're also connecting then to microfilaments. So what you actually have is this connection between the two cells that is hooked up by microfilaments from one cell to the next. And this gives the epithelial sheet rigidity. And you can see that in the next slide. If you look here at the top, this would be a picture of that epithelial sheet. Here would be the nuclei, okay? This would be the adherent junctions with the microfilaments in between them. This would be the apical surface, and this would be the basolateral surface. Okay? Now, what happens now when all of a sudden the signal comes and says, okay, now you're a sheet, okay? Now you, what would happen, okay? In fact, I want to relate this to what's going on actually in the embryo. So this is actually what happens, okay, when the neural tube is going to be built, okay? If you remember, I talked about last week the fact that you have ectoderm on the outside, okay? The endoderm on the inside that forms your digestive tract. And in between, you have mesoderm, which forms most of your organs, okay? So on the outside, you have the ectoderm, this layer on the outside. And I'm going to use just a piece of paper to show you this layer, okay? All of a sudden, there is a tissue inside. We said that the mesoderm, for example, was inside. It happens to be a mesodermal tissue that is underneath here, kind of like my arm, that says, okay, quote, quote, it's time to make the neural tube. Or there are certain ways that these cells influence the cells of this outer layer, okay? And what is actually going to happen is this outer layer is now going to change form because it was told by those other cells to do this. It's in what it does now is now all of a sudden it's going to go like this. One second. I'm going to use my clips to help me. But what you see is that flat piece of paper folded. Okay, and what you get now is a tube, that's the bottom part, okay, and a flat surface on top. So now you have a flat surface and a tube. If you can imagine now that that tube would pinch off from this flat surface, then you'd have a flat surface with a tube underneath it. And that's exactly what happens. The flat page bends up, becomes a tube, and then you have a tube and a flat sheet of epithelium. Okay, now please realize that this obviously is also made out of epithelial cells, but now they're in a tube or a circle. Okay, so now let's talk about what's actually going on with the cytoskeleton to make that happen. Okay, so we have this epithelial sheet. Okay? The first step The first thing that happens is that the microtubules, okay, not the microfilaments, but the microtubules cause this sheet to elongate. So all the arrows in this direction, with microtubules. And so now all of a sudden this sheet becomes longer. But we still have the adherent junctions with the microfilaments. That's step one. What happens next? Now it's time for the microfilaments to come into play that we just spoke about. So the microfilaments are these cables that go through the cell closer to the apical surface, and they get the right signal from their neighbor. And what happens is that the microfilaments now move relative to each other. Okay? They can either move to make things, you know, to expand or to contract. In this case, they're going to contract the apical surface. When they do that, so the microfilaments are contracting, I'm going to put arrows as if in, okay? And what would you get? And now I'm going to go to the next one. And what you see, if I only take four cells, okay, what you see, here would be the adherent junction with the microfilaments, that now they have moved towards each other. And so the apical domain, which would be, this is apical, and okay? Still that basolateral, okay? The apical domain has gotten smaller relative to the basolateral domain. And I like to think of this, if this is my epithelial cell, okay, this is one in a sheet, imagine it with many others, but it's kind of like a purse string. The actin, the microfilament cables across the top pull closed. And so the apical domain is much smaller now than the basolateral domain. Okay, it's like a purse string, just pulls them across. So all of a sudden this constricts the apical domain, okay? And so if all four of those cells did that same procedure, the top would get smaller and there'd be nowhere for it to go, right, because it squeezed the top part, the bottom part would start to fan out. And as a result, you would get something that looked like this, more like a tube, okay? So let's draw our next step. This then would start to look like. Right, imagine that these four cells were part of this tube. So you can imagine them here. Right, this part's still being apical. Okay? And we have our microfilaments across the apical domain. That has some mesoderm below it that influences it to start making this tube. Okay? When it did that, okay, it actually changed so that those cells that were going to make the tube now were induced or caused to, okay, express a different coherin. When they were induced, they now start expressing N-coherin as opposed to, if you remember, the whole epithelial sheet was expressing E-coherin. So they now have actually changed their expression of the proteins to express now N-coherin. So let's add that to our picture. It means that these cells here in the middle are actually expressing now N-coherin. And these cells over here would be expressing E-coherin, but also over here. So now, when it's time to pinch off and close this opening of the tube, okay, the cells that are expressing N-coherin are going to want to touch the cells that are expressing N-coherin. Remember, they like to bind together, the N-coherins. And those that are expressing the E-coherins are going to bind with those that are expressing the E-coherins. So what we get is that these cells, which are expressing the N-coherins, would bind to each other, and these cells, which are expressing the E-coherins, would bind to each other, and this would pinch off. And so in the end, what you'd get our microfilaments, okay, near the apical domain. And this would be now the epidermis. And this would be the neural tube. Now, where would be the apical domain of the neural tube? So it would be in here. So in here would be the apical domain. And so the microfilaments will be closer to that. Now we've gone from one epithelial sheet to a sheet and a tube. Any questions? Yes.
Was that sheet always expressing both types of cations, and is that what forms the changes, or is it the changes that are going to be bringing about?
So when we start off and the zygote starts developing into multiple cells, they all express E-coherence. Okay? And it's that mesoderm underneath the neural tube that induces it to change its expression. Okay? And so now it caused those cells that were right above it to express N-coherence. Yes?
Yeah, when you talked about the initial epithelial sheet expanding, it gets deeper, is it kind of
wider, right?
And longer.
Mostly at this moment, wider, because the microtubules are actually going in this direction, making it wider. Okay, like I have this arrow here. Okay, so it's making it wider this way. And then the microfilaments constrict its apical domain, and so it starts to look like this, and starts to make, you know, have that curvature to form a tube. Okay? Any other questions? Yes?
So we marked that those ones that start to imagine. You show the end coherent starting to be expressed. Do you merely mean the end coherent being expressed on the apical surface?
Oh, so...
Or do you mean it being expressed on the basolateral surface? Or?
So where in that cell?
Yeah.
So in the adherent junctions, so that they can stick to each other, because it's for cell-to-cell interactions. So I should have mentioned, coherents are always for cell-to-cell interactions. Okay? There's other molecules that are important for other kinds, but this is, we're talking cell to cell. So let's say, for example, at the adherent junction, they begin now to express N coherence. And then when they were to join up here, once again, cell to cell interaction, they would use those N coherents to join up to each other. Okay?
Okay, so for that actual pinching off maneuver that's doing right there, it's using N coherence.
For this part, but up here it'd be using E coherence.
Okay.
So it's not, right, both of those need to touch each other and form a complete tissue, and then form a complete tissue here to make a tube. So the N coherence would join, and the E coherence would join, and they're busy not trying to touch each other. Okay? Yes.
And how do E and N differ from each other?
We're not going to go into the molecular structure. That's beyond the course. Okay. So, all my various tubes and all, tough to find what I'm looking for. Okay, so, just to show you that, and I'm going to turn down the lights so you can see that. There's quite a delay on that. Okay, so, if we look at that, as this is occurring, this is the epithelial sheet, which is expressing E-coherence, okay? Whereas this is the neural tube that broke off, and you'll notice that this is expressing N-coherence, and it's closest to the lumen, okay? That's the part that you see is white or glowing or stained, okay? And so you can see that the neural tube is expressing different coherence than is the epithelial sheet that will now cover it. That procedure here is happening in the wild type. We haven't done any manipulations. We see that middle region that has been induced by mesoderm is now expressing N coherence. The outer region is expressing E coherence, and the like coherence attached to each other. And so you get a sheet of cells that will become the outer skin, the epidermis, and you get a neural tube. But what would happen if you would inject, okay? So not normal, right? In an experiment, if you would inject N-coherence into this side of the embryo, and cause this region to express both N-coherence and E-coherence. Well, it turns out when they do that, they never fuse and the neural tube never pinches off. Okay? So it is very important where each of these coherence is expressed in order to get the proper fusion and then the formation of this neural tube and the epithelial sheet above it. Okay, so we've seen the mechanism behind building a tube, which is used frequently in making an organ. Okay, one of the examples, just to let you know, is the first organ that's made in the body is the heart. Okay, the heart actually forms. There are two heart fields on either side of the body. There is some discussion as to whether or not they form tubes on either side of the body and then fuse in the center of the body to form a tube, or they actually first migrate as epithelial sheets and then form a tube at the center of the body. But regardless, either way, they actually, is two sides of the body of heart fields, they migrate along cells as sheets or tubes and form a tube in the middle of your body. And so when your heart first beats, it beats as a linear heart tube, okay? Before it has chambers and all the complex things that you'll learn about later, right? So that's another example of a tube. So we've talked about the neural tube, the heart tube, okay? You'll see that the lens of the eye is a kind of a tube, but it's a sphere, so it's a little different. We got lots of tubes in our bodies. Okay. So, now we've seen the mechanics of making a tube. Now I'd like to talk to you about that process we talk about, induction, okay? How is a cell influenced by its neighbors, okay, to express or make a different set of proteins, or how is it, let's say it isn't influenced by its neighbors, because that's actually the two types of differentiation that there is. You can either be influenced by your neighbors to make those decisions as to what protein you should express, or you can make those decisions on your own, okay? And those are actually two big categories of the types of or ways to determine, or ways of differentiation. And so, I'd like to make a chart of that. Ways to get to differentiate are either you don't care what your neighbors tell you, you do what you want to do, that's called autonomous or working on your own. And the second type or way to differentiate is conditional. In other words, your friends tell you what's going on, you interact, you talk about it, and then you make your decisions. Okay? So that would be conditional. Okay. So I'll begin with conditional. And to do that, I'd like to use here tunicates. Tunicates are a good example of autonomous differentiation. What they are showing you here is if you have, this is here at the 8-cell stage, okay, there's four in the front, and then four in the back, which we don't really see, but here at the 8-cell stage, they look to see that if they took this cell, and they look to see what it becomes later, okay, they see that these top cells always become the outer layer of the body, or the ectoderm. They look at the bottom cells, they see that they become either parts of the endoderm or parts of the mesoderm, which here, you know, the various organs. So it's not important, this word, it says here notochord, it's part of the mesoderm, or muscle, okay? And we're going to deal more with the muscle, okay? So we see that each of these cells would become a different part. Okay, we talked about the three germ layers, either ectoderm, mesoderm, or endoderm. And it really what determines this for them, okay, or I shouldn't say it like that, of course, but each of these cells contains different proteins or mRNAs in their cytoplasm, and depending on which proteins or mRNAs they contain, that's what they will become. So it doesn't matter to them, okay, what their neighbor contains, okay? They care that they, let's say they contain X. If you contain X, become muscle. If you contain Y, become endoderm, regardless of what's happening around you. So some people like to call this type of regulation mosaic, because each of the cells is a tile. If you take out that tile will just be missing. Okay? So if you had an 8-cell stage and you took out one of these cells, okay, you would get 7/8 of an embryo. You'd be missing that piece that you pulled out, or that tile that's missing would just be missing. Okay? The rest of the cells would not know or feel or have any way of detecting that that one piece was missing, and they'd make the rest of the embryo, or 7/8 of an embryo. Okay? And so what really determines this is what is in the cytoplasm of each of these cells, what mRNAs and proteins. And how did they find that out? They did a very interesting experiment that you can see here, and I will lead you through it. So, over here, you can see a picture of the four cells. Imagine that these are the same four cells that you saw a minute ago over here, okay? Right, the top two are blue, okay? And please realize that these are color-coded, so blue being ectoderm, okay? Red or pink being mesoderm, and yellow being endoderm. So you'll notice that those same things, those are what they would normally become, right? Those cells would normally become ectoderm if nothing, if there was no manipulation. Those cells would normally become ectoderm, these cells would normally become mesoderm, and the progenitors of this would normally become endoderm.
And the back four are the same?
Yes. So, if we take those cells, okay, these cells would normally become ectoderm, and these cells would normally give rise to cells that would become both mesoderm and endoderm, okay? If we now, when those cells were dividing, okay, before they finished dividing, if we move some of that cytoplasm with this needle, if we move some of the cytoplasm from these two cells up into these top cells, what you can see they've done here, they've moved some of this red cytoplasm. Now, they've colored it red. What they're trying to say is that there's some protein or mRNA in there that they're moving. Okay, they don't know that yet, but I'm letting you in on the secret, okay? So, they have moved some of this cytoplasm up into these cells so that when you have finally the division, okay, these cells now contain not just the normal cytoplasm that they normally had, they also contain some of that cytoplasm that contains something that's very important for making muscle cells. So now, what's it, that protein or mRNA that's important for making muscle cells exists in these two cells, but now also in these two cells. Okay, you see there's some red left. Okay? And so what we see is that now we get muscle cells from all of the progeny, or all of the cells that these divide into. And it turns out that that protein that was important, that causes you to become muscle, in the case of the tunicates, is acetylcholine esterase, which is an important enzyme for breaking down the neurotransmitter that works, okay, with the synapse between the neuron and the muscle. Okay? So any cell that contains this protein, okay, it's an enzyme that breaks down the neurotransmitter that's used to activate muscle, okay, will become muscle. Regardless of what you do with it, right? So you can move it from one place to another within the embryo, and no matter what cell it ends up in, that cell will become muscle. Okay? So, let's try to fill in our chart then a little bit with this information. In fact, while I'm doing that, I'll turn on the lights just a bit. Okay, so, the mode of differentiation. Thank you. is determined by what's in the cytoplasm. And we call that cytoplasmic determinants, right? Those are those mRNAs or proteins that we were talking about. Really is, what about the timing? Well, these are proteins or mRNAs that are made in the cells very early on, before you have major cell movements. Okay? So normally we think about an embryo that first we have fertilization, then we have multiple cells, but when those cells divide, they just kind of sit down next to each other. Okay? After that, we then have these major cell movements where cells move relative to each other. And this is what I spoke to you about when I said that the ectoderm was on the outside, the endoderm was on the inside, and the mesoderm was in between. Those major cell movements that allow that to happen, okay? So this happens before those major cell movements, okay? So it happens relatively early on. So these cells already know what they're going to be or are determined. If you remember from before, we had the five stages of differentiation. We talked about them being first pluripotent, then bias, then specification, right, then determination, and then finally differentiation. So these cells have already progressed through this whole scale there of differentiation very early on before we have major cell movements. So early on, so time. Want to answer here with this chart is, do the cells next to you or your neighbors matter? Okay? What we learned, do your neighbors matter? No. You don't really care what's going on with your neighbors. Which really means that position is irrelevant. Okay? Position within the embryo. So, what do you think? Does this sound like what we do? What do humans? Does that sound like what humans do? No. Okay. So, what is going on with humans? Now, I should mention, okay, that almost every animal that we've studied, we have found that they're a little bit of a mix of both of these types, of autonomous and conditional, okay? It's not that usually the vertebrates are primarily conditional, but there are lots of exceptions, and almost every animal that you come across has some exceptions. On the other hand, there are animals like C. elegans, a little nematode, okay, a little invertebrate, that is both conditional and autonomous. There are almost, in all the examples you'll look at, at least a little bit of each present as far as how those cells decide which proteins to express. Okay? And so let's now think about what is actually going on in humans. So we say that humans are conditional and at least primarily conditional, I should say. And when we think of that, so we think that, for example, we can have identical twins. We can have one cell, okay, that divides into two, and yet if those cells now, right, separate far enough away from each other, okay, so that they're not interacting, right, because if they do interact, you may have issues with Siamese twins. But if they're not interacting and they're far enough away from each other, you actually can get an entire human from that one cell and an entire human from that second cell, right? So this cell realizes that it's just that cell, right? And so as a result, it's not being induced by neighbors so that it then forms an entire human. Okay? So let's think. So it means that conditional, okay, the mode of differentiation, it's actually being induced by its neighbors or being affected by its neighbors. So inductive. So the timing, right? So if it was very early on, okay, the timing of the induction, let's say for humans, you wouldn't be able to do all kinds of great things, okay? One of the things that we manage that we can do with humans is, for example, pre-diagnostic testing. If you look at, there's a very famous example, it was one of the first pre-diagnostic testings that were ever done. There was a family from New Orleans. It turns out that among the people of French descent in New Orleans, there's a high case of Tay-Sachs. And there was a family that had already had, that was from this descent, that had already had two children with Tay-Sachs, which is a horrible disease where your muscles degenerate and the children die. The maximum that they live is anywhere between 5 and 10 years. Okay? And so this couple asked that they be able to do pre-diagnostic testing to look and see if they could see with those, look at the early embryos and see if they had Tay-Sachs before they were then put back into the female and allowed to develop. So what they did is at the 8-cell stage, they took out one of the 8 cells, tested it for this disease, Tay-Sachs, and only the embryos that were not positive, okay, so that did not contain the mutation for Tay-Sachs, were put back into the female. And then she was able to have a natural, healthy baby, and everything worked fine. But what that really means is that you removed one of the 8 cells, and the other cells, okay, were able to compensate and make a complete individual. In the tunicate, that wouldn't happen. Okay, you'd only get 7/8 of an individual. Okay, which would be a real problem, obviously. So, and what we're seeing really when we start to think about that with the timing, is that this the pathway of differentiation actually occurs pretty late in development, right? So, for the tunicate, it happened very early. Things that were laid down, even let's say when you have multiple cells already, here we've got 8 cells, already there are certain proteins, this acetylcholine esterase, that are in specific cells that have determined their fate, and they can't change that. Whereas here, at the 8-cell stage, all of those cells were still able to change their fate. Okay? So the timing is much later here. So we'll fill that in for timing. What about your neighbors? How important are your neighbors? Well, we can see from that that obviously your neighbors are very important, okay? So, yes. Okay, so position is important. And I'm going to also write that you can change your fate, okay? So, yes. Change. I'd like to kind of give you an idea of what that means. So if, for example, the instructions were when you started out to go 2 blocks, turn left, go 4 blocks, turn right, no matter what, okay? That would be an example of autonomous. Now, obviously, when I say turn left, I mean turn on gene X, and then go 4 blocks and turn on gene Y, okay? I just don't mean to turn left and right, okay? But now let's think what would happen in the example with conditional. It would be go 2 blocks, wait for the girl in the red dress, go 4 blocks, wait for the brown truck. If you see it, turn right. Okay? So it's always a matter of if I see the girl in the red dress, I'll turn left. If I don't, I'll rethink things and maybe do something else. But if you get that signal, then you turn left. Okay? Wait for the truck, the brown truck, when I see it, turn right. Okay? So it's a matter of you do your regular program, but you always need to get feedback to see it, to determine whether or not you'll do that next step. Okay? Okay, any questions before I continue? Okay. So now I'd like to talk to yeah. It's an invertebrate, it's a dicot. It's one of those I don't know how much of it's the ocean, but it's one of those you see when you go and visit in the ocean. There's a picture of it in the book. You're welcome to take a look. Okay? Okay. So our next example that I'm going to talk to you about, and remember that the mechanics are very similar to the mechanics that we talked about for the neural tube, but I'd like to talk to you a little bit about how it gets induced. Okay? Our next example is how the lens of your eye is formed. Okay? And I'd like to remind you of our example from before. If you remember, we had an epithelial sheet that was the ectoderm on the outside, and it invaginated and made a tube underneath it, which was the neural tube. Okay? This neural tube now sends out protrusions, one from each side, as if my fingers are the protrusions, okay? Right? That will form the retina. Okay? And this is the picture that you see next. I realize that you have to try to think about... Oh yes, I should mention. So these next four slides that were on the PowerPoint, I won't speak about today. Numbers 10 through 13. Okay. Yes?
You won't speak about them and we don't
need to know them? Right. So I'll just reiterate what she said. I won't speak about them and you're not responsible for knowing them. Okay? So, what I've just showed you, okay, is really what they're trying to show you on the board. They've taken the head of the animal, okay, with the epithelial sheath and the neural tube, okay, and they've sliced it so that you're slicing the neural tube down the middle, and they've showed you then a view from the top, okay? So please realize that this is the neural tube that I just spoke about, okay, that has just formed, okay, and this is the protrusion that will become the brain, okay? This is the overlying ectoderm, okay, that will become the skin, and there's two protrusions, like I said, that normally form from either side. This would be one. And there would be the same protrusion on the other side. For this experiment, they actually removed it and put it here. But the normal wild-type situation would be to have one that looks just like this on the other side here. So it's a neural tube where the future brain would be here. And then these are these two protrusions that will become the retina. Okay? So this protrusion, before it becomes the retina, is called the optic vesicle. And so what they see is that this protrusion, this optic vesicle, is able to induce, okay, or influence these cells of the overlying ectoderm to invaginate and form the disc of the eye. Right? Now we talked about the mechanics, about how those cells would then form this tube that kind of closes off. And you can imagine it's a little different than before. But if this is the overlying ectoderm, okay, then it's like my hand has pushed into it. And you end up getting the lens and then the surface ectoderm, which will once again then just pinch off. And you'll be left then with the lens, this part here, and the overlying surface ectoderm. Okay? So it's really the same idea, but this time instead of it being a long, you know, a long tube, you're actually pinching it off at 360 degrees, and so you're getting a lens or a sphere, okay? Like my fist. But we see that it's not enough that this optic vesicle induced the overlying ectoderm. It turns out that only the ectoderm of the head is competent to respond to this induction. So there really needs to be two players here. There is the cells that are inducing, and the cells that are responding have to have some way to, let's say you wave at someone and they never see you, it's not going to do you any good. They have to have some way to receive that signal or to be competent to receive that signal. And so what they see is that if they take this optic vesicle and they put it underneath the surface ectoderm, but not in the head region, there is no invagination and a lens does not form. If they remove the optic vesicle in the head region, it also doesn't form. So you can't do it if you don't have something to induce. Okay? And then the fourth example that they've given here is if they put some other tissue underneath the surface ectoderm, it also will not form a lens. Okay? So you need to have both the inducer and a cell that are competent to respond, or we'll call that a responder. Okay? So, until now, I've been saying induce, respond, competent to respond. What are actually the molecules that are responsible for this induction and or response? So, what we see is that if we look at the optic vesicle and at the surface ectoderm, it turns out that the surface ectoderm, even before it is induced by the optic vesicle, expresses a transcription factor called PAC6. As a result, the surface ectoderm is competent to respond. What does that mean? It activates genes, or it causes those genes to be transcribed and translated so that the cells of the surface ectoderm now express receptors to catch that. If someone said hello, to be able to respond. Okay? So, what is it exactly that they are responding to? The optic vesicle secretes two molecules, or ligands, okay? FGF8 and BMP4. These are both soluble ligands. FGF is fibroblast growth factor, and I spoke about other growth factors. And it is a soluble ligand. It uses the tyrosine kinase receptor that Dr. Moshewitz spoke about. If you remember, she spoke about the fact that soluble ligands can use G-coupled receptors, G-protein coupled receptors, and they can also use tyrosine kinase receptors. And she didn't speak very much about that, and she will actually speak some more about that after my lecture. But I'd like you to realize that this actually then is secreted by the optic vesicle in order to, for the ligand, you must bind its receptor. So the surface ectoderm expresses tyrosine kinase receptors, okay? And as a result of a signaling pathway, then expresses a transcription factor called LMEF. In addition, it also secretes BMP4. BMP4 uses a very similar type of receptor. It's actually not a tyrosine kinase receptor. It's a serine because it phosphorylates a different residue on the receptor, so it has a slightly different name, but it's the same kind of receptor. Okay, and it actually then activates a signaling pathway that turns on two transcription factors, SOX2 and SOX3. All of these transcription factors together turn on the genes that are necessary to make lens. think I'll go over here. I'd like to draw then what that means. If we're going to now look specifically at FGF8, because it uses the tyrosine kinase receptor, let's draw out what that means. So, if we have FGF8, okay, this is the inducer. It is actually what is being secreted, okay, it together with BMP4, but we're going to use FGF8 at the moment for our example. It is actually what is inducing the surface ectoderm. So let's go back to our lady in the red dress, okay? So what it means is that this cell, okay, is going along, it's expressing PAX6. If it sees the lady in the red dress, in this case, if it sees FGF8, it will do the next step, okay, which is to activate a signaling pathway. So this is going to be bound, this soluble ligand will be bound by the tyrosine kinase receptor. Which will activate a signaling pathway. Which will turn on what? Any thoughts? On the other board over there, what does FGF8 turn on? What transcription factor? Okay. Now, this transcription factor, right, will then turn on multiple genes. Remember, we talked about before the master regulatory genes, right, we talked about on Thursday, will turn on multiple things. First of all, it will turn on other transcription factors. It will turn on various things that are specific to the lens of the eye, such as crystalline. Now please realize that these transcription factors that are turned on can also turn on other multiple genes, and that LMEF, together with the other transcription factors over there, SOX2, SOX3, and PAX6, okay, will turn on all the genes that are necessary to create a lens. So which transcription factor was it that made the surface ectoderm competent to receive this FGF and BMP4 signal?
PAX6,
okay? So it caused the cell, even before it got the inductive signal, it caused the cell in the head ectoderm to turn on receptors, let's say for example for FGF8, this tyrosine kinase receptor, so that when the signal came, it could respond by activating this signaling pathway, turning on LMEF, and as a result, together with the other transcription factors, activating all the genes necessary to create a lens. Okay? Now, someone will ask me, I know, so what turns on PAX6? Okay? And the answer to that, if you really want all the various reasons and whys and what happens, really you'll need to come hear my developmental biology class because we go into it very, very deeply into it. But what I do want to just give you a little bit of a feel for, it really has to do with what cells the surface ectoderm came in contact with before this process. So there were processes that happened before this, okay, and cells that it interacted with and proteins then were turned on, such as PAX6, as a result of those interactions. Okay? So it's really that we start off with the zygote where we've just had fertilization, and slowly but surely the cells interact with each other, and so different genes are turned on in each cell, and so when the right time comes, the surface ectoderm, because it's gone through these specific interactions, is competent or expresses PAX6, which turns on genes that make it competent to receive the signal from this optic vesicle. Okay? So obviously, if it didn't see FGF8 or the girl with the red dress, it's not going to turn on this cascade and it's not going to make lens. Maybe it'll do something else. Okay? All right. But that's not really the end of the story, because we've made now a lens. But it turns out that now the lens goes and says, I made a lens, and now induces the retina, or this optic vesicle, this protrusion, to actually become the retina. So we have reciprocal induction. So first the optic vesicle induced the lens. Now the lens is going to go and induce the retina. And that you can see here in this next picture. So once you have a lens, it then induces the retina, and then below that the pigmented epithelium. And then once this lens is pinched off, it then induces the overlying ectoderm, because if you remember, once it's pinched off, there's going to be now an overlying epithelium. It now induces the overlying epithelium to become a cornea. So you had that A, or the optic vesicle, induced the lens induced the optic vesicle, and the lens induced the overlying cornea. So reciprocal inductions. Both, what is the mechanism, okay, that you can go from an epithelial sheet to a tube or a sphere? Also, what are the molecules that are behind that induction? Okay, how those cells, one set of cells influences another set of cells. And now I'd like to explain to you a little bit about the molecules that are working here. And we see that they are incredibly conserved between the various species, in that those signaling molecules that we talked about, let's say FGF8 and BMP4 in this example, okay, those are very conserved molecules between the animals in general. Those activate signaling cascades, and then the transcription factors that they turn on are also very conserved. Okay? What really is different is what structural genes, those that are down here, let's say, for example, CRISPR, what structural genes are turned on as a result of those transcription factors being turned on? And I should mention in addition, I've mentioned that FGF8 and BMP4 are turned on here to induce the lens. But they are used for numerous things at different times in the body. Okay? Bone morphogenic protein is very important in making bone. Okay? It's also important in patterning the early embryo. It's got multiple functions at multiple times in the embryo. Okay? So, they wanted to see, if this is true, if they could take a... Remember we talked about those transplantations in the frog, where we took a piece or certain cells from a frog before it was determined, and we transplanted those cells into another embryo and looked to see if their fate could change. We'd like to see if we could do that same thing, but between species. So we'd like to take a piece of the frog, okay, that would normally become back, okay, let's say here, and transfer it into a region of a newt, so a different species, into a region that would normally become mouth, and see if, okay, if we did this early enough, if we could get this, the fate of those cells to change, which would imply that the molecules that were doing the induction were the same kind of molecules, because those cells need to respond by having, let's say, in our example, obviously this is not the same molecules in the mouth, but let's say in our example, you'd have to have that those cells were expressing the right tyrosine kinase receptor to respond to the FGF8, okay? So they wanted to see if they could transfer those cells and have the cells change their fate and respond to the signals that are in a different species. And what did they see? They saw that if they transplanted these cells that these cells actually did become the mouth region, which is what, this was the region that you'd expect. And this region normally becomes mouth, and these cells that were transplanted from the frog into the newt did become mouth. So it means the signals that the cells that were transplanted were able to receive those signals, express the correct receptors, receive those signals, and became what would normally become mouth. But there was one caveat to this, and that is that those cells can only become the, they can only express the proteins for which they have genes. So normally, right, in a frog, the mouth of a frog normally has suckers. The mouth of a newt normally has balancers. They don't look exactly the same. The frog cells have in them genes to express proteins for suckers. They don't have genes to express the correct proteins to make balancers. So even though the signaling molecules to cause them to change fate and know that they are no, right, so respond and make and become mouth, okay, were the same molecules. But what those structural genes that were activated as a result are not the genes that are present are not the same genes as for the newt. So you do get mouth, but you get a mouth that looks like a frog's mouth and not a mouth that would look like a newt's mouth with balancers. So you get suckers, okay, which is what a frog's mouth normally looks like, but you do not get balancers because you can't make proteins that you don't have genes for. Okay, you can only make those genes, okay, that you contain in your DNA. You can only make the proteins that come from the genes that you contain in your DNA. So what we see is that the signaling molecules and the transcription factors are conserved, but the effect or the structural genes that are turned on are different. And this is a very common theme that we see in development. Okay? If we do the reverse experiment, where we take a newt, okay, and we take cells from the back region and we transplant them into what would normally become the frog's mouth, we do get mouth, but we get newt mouth with balancers, because that, of course, is the only kind of mouth that they have the genes, that those cells have the genes to make the proteins to become. Okay? Now, they've done an experiment because of the fact we see that this is true and there's this conservation of the signaling molecules and transcription factors. They took mouse PAX6, okay, right? PAX6 was the molecule we talked about before, the transcription factor that was needed to make this overlying head ectoderm competent to respond to the signal that it would get from the optic vesicle, okay? They took mouse PAX6 and transplanted it into a frog, I'm sorry, not into a frog, into a fly, okay? So an invertebrate, and look to see what happened. Now, if they would have put it into an eye region, they already got eyes, so that wouldn't help. What they did is they put it into a different region, they put it in onto the wing, okay? They injected just the protein, okay, into the wing of the fly, and look to see what happened. They got an eye. Okay? So the eye formed on the wing. Now, you have the transcription factor, okay, the protein, that turns on the genes that are present in the fly. So it looks like a fly eye. Even though it's a mouse, PAX6, it's conserved enough that it turns on those genes, okay, that would normally be turned on by fly PAX6. And you get an eye. Now, just to try to think about this, what would happen if you would take cells, okay, from the mouse that were expressing PAX6, where the PAX6 master regulatory gene, right, had K4 methylated on its histone, but K27 not, and was being actively transcribed and you took those cells and you transplanted them onto the wing of a fly. Now, they haven't done that, but we can imagine from what we've seen what might happen. You would imagine that you would get a mouse eye, because the PAC6 could only activate the genes that were within those cells, and those are mouse cells. So you would get a mouse eye. Okay? And so this conservation between the species is really rather amazing. And we see that there are four signaling pathways that are really pretty much used in development that are conserved between all animals. Okay? You see at least one member of each of these families in all of the animals that we know of. And we have used two of them today. The first two that are listed here are wingless and hedgehog, which are used very frequently. But the next two, fibroblast growth factor, which we just spoke about, okay, which uses the tyrosine kinase receptor. And this last group here, it says TGF-beta, which is a large group of proteins that includes BMP4. Okay? And these are really the four families of signaling molecules involved in development. So to finish up, I'd like to just mention today that in the New York Times Science, I was very lucky, Dr. Moshowitz opened up the New York Times Science, and what did she see? There was an article in there about evolution and how well conserved everything is. And so just to finish up, I'd like to read you a little bit about what's going on in this conservation between the species. So it says, the components can be altered without wreaking havoc on the parts and systems that connect to them, and can even produce a reasonably functioned organ or body part in their modified configuration. So he talks about the fact that cells are very modular, that there are these modules, and then it can be swapped and switched to different places in the body. And then they kind of end with, evolution has flipped and shuffled and retrofitted and duct taped together a comparatively small set of starter parts to build a dazzling variety of botanic and bestial bodies. And I think that's a great way to end, because it's really true. All of the animals are busy using these same signaling molecules and transcription factors to build the incredible variety that we have of animals and plants in the world. Yeah.